Matt, let's get started with Anthony Blinken's visit to Israel. What do we get from this visit?
I can tell you what I got watching. I got a lot of heartburn. My blood pressure increased, you know, a lot of, okay, when I talked to Nima in a couple hours, I got to really try hard not to curse. you know, the absurdity, the spectacle of if people watched or if you watch it, you know, recorded or read it, the lying that occurs, but the prostitution of the United States for Israel, you couldn't have a better showcase for it than what we saw today with Anthony Blinken in Jerusalem. He was a man who just speaks about an upside down reality. He tells you it's sunny outside when it's raining. It's incredibly Orwellian. His description of things, of what's occurred, what has occurred, his insistence that has everything to do with October 7th, whose side he is on, as if we need any more explanation of that, any more detail of that. We know this because of the tens and tens of billions of dollars of weapons the U.S. keeps sending to Israel, the 14,000, 2,000 bombs we've sent to Israel since October 7th. But Anthony Blinken presents himself as a neutral arbiter, as a mediator. And of course, you know, it gets exposed at times. And during the question and answer, the reporters asking him after his statement, you know, you see that. What happens if this deal doesn't go forward? He gets asked. And he said, well, there's two main things that we're concerned about: the hostages being released and intervening events, meaning that this breaks out into a larger war. And of course, that's all fine and good. But for a man to stand there and say that what matters if this doesn't get done, if we don't get a ceasefire deal in place, and just to leave out any reference at that point to what is happening in Gaza, to the genocide, the forced relocation, the domicide, as they're calling it, the destruction of the whole society, the fact that polio is occurring now, the deliberate starvation, on and on and on. For him to just ignore that and to say, if we don't get this deal, what's going to happen is the hostages' lives are going to be in danger, and something else bad might happen in terms of, you know, larger regional war. And you see that, and he gives himself away, and it's so disgusting. Right. He talked today about a sense of urgency. There's an urgency to this deal. And reports were this morning that Blinken had said that this is the last chance for a deal. And when he got asked about that, he sidestepped it and, you know, was able to disassemble that report from earlier that this is the last chance. And he said something along the lines of, like, we're always going to be trying for a ceasefire or whatever, you know, the verbiage they use, this disingenuous, specious, vague, you know, nothing is ever going to, you know, you can't ever pin them down on anything. But what he's talked about throughout his statement, he said it a couple times, the urgency of getting this deal done. And what he was referring to sitting here in the United States watching this was the need to have something for Kamala Harris to talk about on Thursday. And so whether when she gives her address to the DNC, when she publicly accepts her nomination as a Democratic Party's nominee for the presidency, she either needs to be able to, if a deal is done, announce that as, you know, this victory, right? We got a ceasefire in place. Donald Trump and Republicans could never have done what we've done. We got a ceasefire in place. All you out there in the streets who are upset about Palestine, we got this done. You've nothing to be upset about anymore, on and on. We were always right to say we were working hard on this. All the smoke that you can imagine her blowing about it. Or the other thing is that, look, once again, Hamas said no. Once again, the Israelis agreed to a ceasefire and Hamas walked away from it. These people are, you know, and of course, no recognition of the fact that the Israelis just murdered the chief negotiator for Hamas. No recognition of the U.S. role in terms of supporting Israel to make it so that there's no reason for Israel not to continue It's genocide. All it's getting is support upon support from the U.S. So what's the reason to stop? You know, none of that's going to be mentioned, of course. And then, of course, inkling at all would come from the Democratic Party that these everything they're talking about, these deals, these negotiations, it's always been in bad faith. So you saw that today, couldn't have been a better example of the bad faith of the United States. The United States' desire for war rather than peace, the United States Empire's desire for its vassals, its proxy wars to be victorious than Blinken's statement today. And you put that into the context of who our allies are, whether it be Israel murdering the negotiators from the other side, or say the Ukrainians launching an invasion into Russia, scuttling any chance for peace talks for the foreseeable future. And Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, just made that very clear today as well. No chance for peace talks in the coming future. So this is who the United States is, right? This is who we are. Watching this, it's just, as you can tell, I'm obviously upset about it because it's just so disgusting. And more than the fact of the Orwellian fiction involved in all this, it's the danger, right? Where is this leading to? Of course, it's going to lead to the continued slaughter of the Palestinians, but on a larger extent, where does this lead to? Whether, you know, we're talking about the Middle East or to Eastern Europe, and of course, we could always talk about the Far East as well, because we're also doing everything we can, it seems, in this country to get ourselves into three wars at one time.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that Antony Blinken and his administration is trying to take an advantage of what's going on between Iran and Israel. And it seems that Iran is waiting to some sort of agreement go happening in this talks between Israelis and Gazans. But you don't see any sort of rigidity, any sort of will on the part of the Biden administration to put this sort of pressure on them and take opportunity, just using this particular time that we know a lot of tensions going on in that region between Iran and Israel. That's why they have the leverage, in my opinion, to do that right now.
And yeah, they do. And Blinken, right now. Yeah. And Secretary Blinken himself said it today during his press conference that the way to avoid all out regional war is through a ceasefire deal. Of course, what they mean by that is this mechanism that would allow to Blinken, the Americans, Netanyahu, the Israelis, ceasefire is interchangeable with Hamas, which is interchangeable, of course, with Palestinian surrender. And that, as we know, because it was reported yesterday by outlets like Axios, in Hamas has said it, you know, yesterday when they said we're not going along with this, we're out, we're not signing on to this deal because this is what the deal looks like, you know. And for people who aren't familiar with this, essentially what you had back in May, which is what the United States and Israelis insist is what the deal is, which it's not, because we know it's not, but it was this quote Biden Netanyahu plan unquote that called for a 6-week ceasefire, exchange of hostages. That builds into a second phase, which, you know, leads towards further exchange of hostages and prisoners and captives. And then that then leads into a permanent ceasefire. And then that leads into the reconstruction of Gaza. That was the Biden 3-phase plan that the Americans swore up and down came from the Israelis. The Israelis, of course, never really seemed to sign on to it. They said they agreed with it. And then when Hamas said, okay, yeah, let's do this, the Israelis then threw, you know, Netanyahu, but it's the Israelis, then threw a whole bunch of other demands, right? They moved, you know, in the English parlance, you know, they moved the goalposts down the field, right? They kept moving what the actual agreement was. They kept editing it, changing it, adding things in. Many of them were, anathema to Hamas and to the Palestinians. You know, so now what the agreement no permanent ceasefire. No, which of course, by that, if you don't have that, you know, there's no way for negotiations toward a Palestinian state, which we know is completely off the table because the whole entire Israeli government, with the exception of the few Arabs that are in the Knesset, are totally in favor of making sure there's never a Palestinian state. They voted on it. It's very clear. No Palestinian state whatsoever. So, I mean, there's no entry. There's no, where do those negotiations go to? Why would Hamas and the Palestinians sign up for something like that anyhow? But then further aspects of this deal, as we understand it, that the United States and Israel are saying is the thing that Hamas must accept. And of course, this will be what they hang Hamas on for not accepting, is that this deal allows Israel to resume its attacks at any time. It allows Israel to maintain. The Israelis have divided Gaza with an east-west corridor that divides Gaza into a north and a south, and that's the Netzarim corridor. They're allowed to keep that. They're allowed to keep their troops in what's called the Philadelphia corridor, which is that border between Gaza and Egypt, right? I mean, so essentially a permanent garrison of Israeli forces, an occupation of Gaza, you know, I mean, and other things too, you know, in terms of movement of Palestinians back to their homes and other aspects, all these things which are something that Hamas and the Palestinians cannot accept. And they have said they will not accept. And it was nothing that was part of the deal in May. And now here we have to watch Tony Blinken. We're going to have to watch Kamala Harris on Thursday say how this is all on the Palestinians, that there's not a ceasefire in place, and all these dead children, you know, the 10, 15 dead children every day is a result of Hamas not negotiating, of using human shields for their own vainglorious, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's what we're looking at. That's what we're staring at. That's the reality of this. You know, how that changes, the United States is clear that it will not use any leverage whatsoever to force the Israelis to, you know, accept anything that might bring about not even a full peace, right? Not even a full settlement, but a respite. You're not even going to see that. The Israelis would rather continue their young men and women be thrown into Gaza, killed and wounded. Their casualties are about 1,000 a month at the risk of like catching polio now, right? I mean, they'd rather do that than acquiesce in any way that brings about some type of resolution, some type of ending of this genocide. And this answers a lot of our questions we had over the last several months about who was going to win out in this tension, in this turmoil within Israel. Because we go back, what, about 3 months or so, and Benny Gantz leaves Israel's war cabinet, and, you know, and there's all these questions about, okay, Israeli elections maybe in October, and what's going to happen? Can Netanyahu's coalition survive this? And who would Netanyahu go with, the center left or with the right wing religious fanatics like Benjamin, Bezalel Smotrich and Ben Gavir? I did this with you last time. I messed his name up. But anyway, I think we've seen what the answer is on that, that the Israelis, the Netanyahu government, is going to go with the right wing, and they're not going to cede anything, and they're going to see this genocide, this ethnic cleansing carried out. And this is something that I think is really difficult to accept, that we could be here at this time next year with the same things occurring, the same constant news coming in, the same videos of just this industrial slaughter of Palestinians, you know. So at this time there, next year, there might be 100,000 dead Palestinians that we know of, because there's many more who we don't know of. And of course, those who are going to die from the causes of starvation and disease and exposure and so forth. You know, it's very, very possible, Nima, that again, this time next year, it's still going on, because that seems to be as if where not just the Israelis have committed to, and they've got the full support of their public in this, and what the Americans have committed to, right? If the Americans could have gotten a deal, again, if the Democratic Party, which is the party in power, could have gotten a deal that they could promote at their convention this week for their own domestic political purposes, they would have. But if not, so be it. We'll go forward. You know, this is pro-Palestine sentiment is actually rather insignificant to us at this point. That's what they'll tell themselves. Maybe that's the way it'll play out. We'll see. The dangers, of course, then is where does it go? And so what we saw happen this weekend was a car bomb, a van exploded in Tel Aviv. And the Hamas and PIJ, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, took credit for that. The only person hurt was the suicide bomber himself. So we assume this is an accidental detonation. But whether it was an accidental detonation, or the Israelis somehow intercepted it and were able to detonate it before, you know, whatever the story is on this, or you could be fanciful and say this was a warning from Hamas. Doesn't make any sense why they let the guy blow himself up. Just blow the van up by itself then. But anyway, this idea though is that this may be what's coming, right? And people in the United States and people in Israel have to accept that. Well, if your excuse for this genocide has been human shields the entire time, self-defense the entire time, and you can justify this Israeli massacre of civilians by the idea that perhaps among the 100 dead in that bombing was one Hamas member, that makes it legitimate. Well, you know, that makes any bus stop where any Israeli soldier is standing a fair target. Right. That makes any restaurant when an Israeli soldier is sitting in a fair target. I mean, so where this could go to. So not only is it what do we see this time next year? You know, it's still going. But what has it developed into? Are we back to where we were 25 years ago with the suicide bombers? Is that what it's going to go back to? And of course, overarching all this. And thank you for letting me go on like this as well. But overarching in all this gets back to the thing you brought up about Iran. And Iran has held back, obviously, more time to prepare, more time to coordinate with the Yemenis, with Hezbollah, the Syrians, with whoever, the Iraqis. But, you know, allows them more time to receive air defense missiles and electronic warfare systems from Russia and get them plugged into their systems and their networks. But what it does is it shows that the Iranians are willing to give this ceasefire process another chance. And so getting back to what Blinken said about this being a last chance, you can see that. So at least there's some element in truth, at least in what Blinken was saying there, some element, because most of this has got to do, Blinken's statements got to do with the relationship between Washington and Tel Aviv, and of course the Democratic Party's own domestic political concerns. But certainly I think the Iranians avoided the quick trap that I think Israel was setting with their assassination of Haniyeh, right? So this idea, if you look at it in a sense of not only do you kill their negotiator, but if you get the Iranians to react in a way that you can then portray as they're the ones to blame for these ceasefire talks falling apart, hey, that's a great propaganda win. And this is what they did back in April. I mean, remember the Israelis attacked the Iranian consulate in Damascus, clear violation of international law, clear war crime. Back here in the States, when Iran retaliated, I mean, you had newspapers, major newspapers, saying that Iran's attack on Israel was unprovoked. They just completely forgot, willingly. This was no ignorance. This was just the arrogance, the entitlement of the corporate media that is part of the American empire to just say those events didn't happen, right? This willful disappearance, this willful forgetting of, you know, the precipitating cause of Iran's strike on Israel in April. And so you have to know they would do it again. So if Iran was to attack Israel, then it's going to be nothing about Israel's assassination of Haniyeh in Tehran during the presidential inauguration, right? I mean, he couldn't have had a bigger slap to the face, something that warranted a response. But the American media and the Israeli media as well as probably some friendly outlets in the UK and other places, are going to go along with this thing that it's the Iranians who are doing this And of course, the talks, of course, ceasefire in Gaza has to be denied at this point, because look at what the Iranians are doing. And the Iranians and the many running the whole train, the whole propaganda of October 7th was not done by the Palestinians because they were being kept in a concentration camp. It was done because the Iranians had them do it, right? I mean, so you just see how this all spins, you know, and that's why I think, you know, one, it's prophetic to be able to say this to an event like this, particularly after submitting myself to watching Blinken. But, you know, you see this chain and you can see where it goes and what comes from it. And then you can get a good idea speculating or imagining what might come next. And it's, yeah, an absolute horror show what might come next.
Yeah. Here is what he said, considering the tensions between Iran and Israel.
Man. That we put into practice virtually every day since October 7th, including when Israel was attacked directly by Iran back in April. In recent weeks, given the heightened tensions, we have deployed additional assets to the region. The purpose of the deployment of these assets is not to provoke aggression, but rather to deter it, to make sure that it doesn't happen, but also to make clear that if it does, we are fully prepared to defend Israel. We've coupled this effort with an intense diplomatic campaign, virtually a global diplomatic campaign, working with countries around the world to send the message strongly to every concerned party not to take any steps that would escalate tensions, that would risk provoking a wider conflict. And this, too, has been something we've been working on from day one since October 7th. It's been one of our primary objectives to prevent the conflict from escalating, from spreading to other places. And so this coupling of our military commitments, our security commitments, with an intense diplomatic campaign is something that I'm pursuing on this trip, again, with the intent of making sure that we deter further conflict, but that we're also clearly prepared to defend against it if it comes. But what's most crucial now is that everyone refrain from taking any actions that could fuel further conflict, escalate tensions, result in the spreading of violence and conflict.
Yeah, Matt.
I expect. Look, BRICS has what, 8 members in it now, and a half dozen or dozen or so on the waiting list, I think. You know, after today, after watching that, you have to imagine a lot more countries saying, hey, we need to get away from the Americans as quickly as possible. They've been saying that for a long time now. But then watching that type of disrespect.
I think it's 10 countries right now.
Is it 10? Is it 10? Yeah. It's up to. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a bunch on the waiting list. And, you know, I mean, yeah. But you can just imagine that if you're in the foreign ministry someplace, any place around the world, and you watch that. And again, coupled with all the context of what's come before, but you just watch this clear disrespect that Tony Blinken has for anyone who is watching or listening to what he says outside of his constituency, right? So outside of the Americans and Israelis and the few in the Brits and whoever, but they've lost the Brits to a degree, you know, I mean, like, so it's just really like who his audience is outside of that. It's just this complete disdain and disrespect and arrogance, the entitlement of the empire. We're going to do what we want, and we're just going to call it whatever we want. Language has no meaning to us. We're just going to do what we want, and you have to go along with it. So you have to sit here and listen to me describe how this the idea of sending American missiles to Israel is for defense only, and how other nations have to knock off their aggression in the region, and that tension needs to be dialed back by all sides, as you know, the United States gave Israel $23.5 billion of weapons last week and munitions. I mean, like, so just having to sit here and take this. So if you're in a foreign ministry someplace, why wouldn't you go to your boss and say, hey, you know what? We need to get away from these people. We cannot trust anything they do or say. We've seen it already. I mean, like, how much more do we need to see? Come on, boss. I've been here for the last 25 years. You know, I've witnessed Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria. You know, look at Ukraine. Look at what they did pulling out of anti-ballistic missile treaty, INF, open skies. You know, I mean, you can't trust these people. You cannot trust them. We have to get away from them, and we need to link arms with others to stand up against this American empire. You know, I mean, how is that not what the response in foreign ministries across the world right now, witnessing that? And of course, again, that's on top of, this is just the top of the pyramid, the tip of the iceberg of what the U.S. has been doing and saying for decades now. We'll just cap it off 30 years ago in the post-Cold War era to make it easy, you know? But so you watch that and you just, you know, it's magnificent in its arrogance. It's the splendor of their entitlement is just something to behold. I mean, this is truly imperial. I mean, this is the stuff of Rome. You need a Edward Gibbon to write this type of history, you know, because it is just so amazing what we are witnessing, and it's real and it's happening. And you know, as Blinken was saying that, how many Israeli kids were dismembered by? I mean, excuse me, how many Palestinian kids were dismembered by American bombs in Gaza today? You know, what was occurring as he was uttering those words? I mean, so, you know, the consequences, how other nations are going to respond to this, and what's going to come. And I think we spoke about this last week, right? Like, you know, perhaps regional war breaks out tonight, 6 weeks from now, 6 months from now, 6 years from now. You know, we don't have crystal balls. We don't know. We can see what's aligning here, and we can see what's coming. And we, the American empire, have built an inevitability into this, where how does this get stopped? How is the brakes thrown on this? You know, because you just see the inertia that comes from, you know, the weight of the American empire, whether it's through the words of their senior statesmen, or through the actual reality of 3 to 4 C-17 cargo planes landing every day in Israel, dropping off more bombs.
Medvedev recently was talking about the solution to the conflict in the Middle East is a, maybe with this current situation, would be a big war in the Middle East. And when I saw this comment, I said, why do we need to have a greater war to have a big war in the Middle East? And right now, when I look at what Antony Blinken he's saying right now, considering just threatening, intimidating all other countries not to attack Israel because they have a lot of weapons to defend Israel and other countries as well, United Kingdom, United States, all of these countries. But at the end of the day, do we know if behind the scene he dares to say to Netanyahu that if we will leave Israel right now, you cannot defend yourself. That's why you have to listen to us. This is, I think we need
something
like this.
Yeah, no, I mean, Netanyahu's counter will be, you know, if Joe Biden stops sending me weapons, I'll have your Congress impeach him. You know, the Israelis are in control here. They're in control of American foreign policy with regards to the Middle East. Just as in the United States, Big Pharma is in charge, you know, the big pharmaceutical corporations, which we call here Big Pharma, they're in charge of our healthcare policy, right? Just, you know, I mean, we have a system here of legalized bribery. The Israelis know it. There is just a report this weekend, actually, some documents, a group out there, a hacktivist group working in the best manner of WikiLeaks. And you know, our friend Julian Assange, if I can get myself figured out here with the camera, you know, working in the best spirit and manner, you know, got these documents out of the Israeli Justice Ministry. And among other things is this documentation that the Israelis, they just don't fully understand how the American Foreign Agent Relations Act, the requirement to register as a foreign agent, how American citizens are not supposed to be working on behalf of foreign countries without explicitly being denominated as a foreign agent. It's not just the Israelis are aware of that, but they actively work to get around it. And then when you read these documents, you see what's in between the lines here is that the Israeli lobby is a full force effort that comes from Tel Aviv. It is a system that has been put in place over many decades that originates from Israel in terms of what the requirements are. And you'll see splits at times. We saw splits earlier this year between the Israeli lobby in the United States and Netanyahu, right? I mean, you'll see splits between them. But overall, the idea that they are foreign agents is very clear, and the Israelis know that, and they use it. They use it for those purposes of dictating American foreign policy with regards to the Middle East. The idea of Blinken threatening Netanyahu, it gets undone by the fact that Netanyahu can one up him, and that was the purpose of Netanyahu's visit last month. I mean, sure, there are other discussions that came on. Certainly this $20 billion weapon sale would have been a part of that. Maybe some discussions about U.S. involvement with regards to Hezbollah. I doubt they discussed openly the assassinations that followed Netanyahu's time here in the United States, Fouad Shikar in Lebanon and Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. But certainly the notion, or certainly, I guess, the reality, what really came out of that visit was this notion, was this understanding that Netanyahu is in control. He said that, we talked about this before. Like, it wasn't that he just united Congress, got his 58 standing ovations in 54 minutes or whatever the number came out to, but he had them kneel and kiss his ring. And he showed clearly who's in charge. That visit, showing up in the middle of the American general election campaign for the president, in the middle of the two major parties' conventions, it showed who was in charge. Benjamin Netanyahu was in charge. So even if Blinken had the gall, the guts, the integrity to suggest something like that to Netanyahu, Netanyahu's counter would be very quick and very easy. So this is the circumstances we're in, and it's a very dangerous circumstance too, because I keep saying that's dangerous, no kidding. But it's a very dangerous situation we're in with regards to American political reality right now, our environment right now. You have a lame duck American president. I think most people have forgotten that Joe Biden is still the president. I think the Democrats want it to be that way. The major media seems to want it to be that way. And you have a Republican who is running for president, who showed his support for Israel so clearly in his last term in office. But then, this weekend, I don't know if you saw this down there in Brazil, Nima, people are upset here in the United States because we have in the military, the highest award is the Medal of Honor. For civilians, the highest award is the Medal of Freedom. And Donald Trump was talking about how he gave Miriam Adelson, who is the widow of Sheldon Adelson, both incredibly huge pro-Israel, Israel first Americans. I mean, massive in terms of the amount of money they provide for that cause. Donald Trump had given Miriam Adelson the Medal of Freedom. And as he was describing this, he said that he went on to say how the Medal of Freedom is a better medal than the United States military's Medal of Honor, which you can imagine in the pro-military, jingoistic, quasi-religious American worship of the military, how that went over. And then you have Kamala Harris, who is ready to take the nomination on Thursday. And getting back to what Blinken was talking about today, it's this idea of, like, is the speech going to be about Is it going to, well, it'd be about a lot of things, of course, but with regards to the Middle East, to Israel and Palestine, is it going to be about how the Democrats were able to get a ceasefire? Or more than likely, it's going to be how Hamas, we've tried and tried, Hamas, you know, they just can't come to the table. The only way to deal with these people is you have to kill them, which is essentially, right, what we've heard about the Russians, right, for the last 2.5 years. You can't talk to the Russians, you can only kill them. You know, you can't talk to the Iraqis, you can only kill them. You can't talk to the Libyans, you can only kill them. You can only, the only thing Bashar Assad understands is force, is violence. I mean, like, right? I mean, so this is what we should expect. You know, and that's the political situation in the United States right now. So what better time are the Israelis going to have to carry out whatever plans they want to carry out? You know, they have what better opportunity are they going to have than right now with this, you know, uncertain American political situation? So, I, you know, of course, if you were them, if I were them, if folks watching, and we were of their mindset, had their black hearts and their black souls, we would likely operate in the same way.
You talk about Donald Trump. I remember he said that whoever is not, who's not agreeing with what our policy is on Israel, we can deport them. Yes. How you can do that? These are American citizens.
They don't care. They don't care. Hey, look, Barack Obama murdered an American citizen with a drone, and then they killed his kids, you know, Milwaukee. And, you know, he got away with it. I mean, I'm sure they could find a way. There's a lot of things that are very troubling in the U.S. right now. A lot of things. There's a bill that's going to get through Congress eventually that's going to allow the U.S. Treasury Department to delist nonprofits here in the United States for support of terrorists. No due process or anything like that involved. Just you support terrorists, right? And then from that, once you have that stripping of a nonprofit status, you also have to realize that in conjunction, in parallel, there will be Justice Department efforts to go after these people who support terrorists. So what will be, not only will be this IRS finding, which can destroy nonprofits by taking away their tax exempt status, but that determination in itself is what the Justice Department thing uses to go after these people, after these organizations, right? So, and we saw, like, hey, look, last week, you know, a lot of folks watched Judge Napolitano, right? And Judge Napolitano was taken off of the air. YouTube took him off the air. We have no idea why. Judge Napolitano referenced an episode with Pepe Escobar. I listened to that episode because you can still hear it by podcast, or you can watch it on Rumble, I think, or some other places. And there is nothing in that discussion between Judge Knapp and Pepe Escobar that should have triggered anything. What I heard was an incredibly insightful, intelligent commentary and analysis of the type and nature that American political leaders should be receiving from their intelligence officers. I mean, that was the reality of Pepe Escobar's conversation with Judge Knapp. And for whatever reason, that was enough to give the judge a strike on YouTube and take him off. And so what you have is this relationship between the corporations and the government, which, you know, some definitions of fascism are exactly that, you know, but this idea that all you need is some type of determination that you are supporting terrorists, that you are saying the wrong thing, and then the whole system can begin to be brought down upon you, that all kinds of things can be pulled away from you. And then, of course, the enforcement comes on top of you. I mean, this is unconstitutional, what's occurring, not just in the free First Amendment aspect of it, which is clear, right? But the idea that, you know, what people will say is, well, YouTube's a private corporation. YouTube, of course, belongs to Google. They can make up their rules as whatever they want. Yeah, fine. Totally agree with you, except that this corporation receives hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in contracts from the American government, their board and their whole operating network, their whole higher executive leadership, not their whole, but a good portion, particularly when you get into their national security, cybersecurity type of roles, where do those people come from? They come from the CIA, they come from the NSC, they come from the FBI. I mean, there's an exchange here, the amount of money that Google puts into congressional campaigns, right? The relationship between not just the executive branch, but the legislative branch with these tech companies, the revolving door I just described. This all shows that there is not a separation between government and corporations that you can say Google has an independent policy, independent guidelines with regards to how they police or censor their content. I mean, where we're heading here in the sense of what's allowed to be said and who's making that decision, and then the consequences therein for our rights to not just say what we want, but to read what we want, watch what we want, listen to what we want. You know, and you see it done in a way that it gets excused, that the major corporate media goes along with this idea that somehow it's fair, it's there's a neutral arbitration going on here. You know, it's the way Facebook does it. So Facebook says our content moderation, our partner with when we talk about international affairs and the military and those types of national security things, we turn to the Atlantic Council to be the arbiter of what's true. You know, what's factual and what's disinformation, what's misinformation, you know, what is just propaganda that these useful idiots are regurgitating up a half of, you know, take your pick, right? The communists in China, the oligarchs in Russia, the mullahs in Iran, take your pick. But anyway, and who's the Atlantic Council? Well, the Atlantic Council is the preeminent think tank of NATO. You right? I mean, the Atlantic Council is filled with former U.S. military government officials, European military government officials. Their funding entirely comes from either the weapons industries or NATO governments. I think they also get money from the Middle East governments, from the monarchies there, right? So it's like, this is who your neutral arbiter is? I had this happen to me a bunch of years ago, like 15 years ago, 14, I guess it was, 2010. I'm on CNN and I get told, hey, look, we can't have you on by yourself because you're not deemed to be neutral. People say you have an agenda. My agenda was get us out of Afghanistan. Exactly. And they said, so we have to bring on someone who's neutral, who's independent. And I said, okay, all right, go ahead. And they said, okay, it's going to be Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institute. O'Hanlon, who was like the biggest cheerleader for the war in Iraq. O'Hanlon, who was big cheerleader for the war in Afghanistan. O'Hanlon, who was like, you know, he goes to dinner and with David Petraeus, and he's, you know, friends with Stan the Crystal. I mean, like the idea that he is somehow independent and neutral in his professional dealings and his personal dealings, but also too, the Brookings Institute takes millions of dollars from the Pentagon. They take millions of dollars from the State Department. They take millions of dollars from anyone who is anything other than neutral on these debates of war and peace. But CNN presented him, and they did it, not blushing, as someone who is independent and neutral. And I'm sure everyone who's listening and watching fully aware that you all could provide a lot of examples of where you see that. And that's the, you know, so you have this relationship of government, the tech industries, and corporate media, right? And then, of course, the military industrial complex. This makes up the empire as we see it in our faces. And so that allows for the censorship, the suppression. That allows for, this continuation of a narrative, for the messaging, for the propaganda to go on, and for the silencing of any dissent. And this is a big challenge for us because we certainly can put out the content. You know, we have people like you, right? We have people like Judge Knapp. We have really great content creators out there who provide a platform for people to come and speak about what's really going on in the world. And the problem is going to be is that with this relationship between the government, the tech companies, and the corporate media, how do we distribute it, right? How do we get it out? You can have the best guests like you do, right? You could have Ambassador Freeman on, you can have Larry Johnson, you can have my friend Ray McGovern on, right? You can have the wisest, most experienced minds out there. But if you can't get in front of people, what does it matter, And this is the challenge I think that we're really up against in these next 5-10 years of countering the empire's propaganda, letting people know what's really going on in the world. This idea of distributing our content, of getting that information out to people, that's the you know, proverbial nut we have to crack.
And we have to mention, before wrapping up this session, Matt, we have to mention that all of these people that you've mentioned together with you are just talking about the future of the United States. All matters is the future of the United States, because it would be better for the next generations, because you're concerned about the situation in the United States and you're not against the United States. This is the main, I think, the main message of you and Ray McGowan, Scott Ritter, Larry Johnson, all of these people, Ambassador Chas Freeman. I think the United States needs you, all of you, to talk about what's going on really, and how it's going to hurt the United States in the future and right now.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. You know, I do find it odd that I'm included in that group, you know, that I'm on the same channels as Jeff Sachs or John Mearsheimer or Larry Wilkerson. You know, I'm able to call some of those people friends. Been very, very lucky, very grateful and blessed for that. But it is, that's the case. That's what certainly our hearts bleed for what the Palestinians are going through. I mean, my heart breaks for both the Ukrainian and the Russian boys who are getting slaughtered over there, for the reasons of megalomania and greed, right? I mean, like, that is just, it breaks my heart seeing that. You know, those are my brothers, whether they're Ukrainian or they're Russian, you know, the same in Palestine. Even for these Israeli kids, like, I feel for them. They shouldn't be, the position they're being put in, the way they've been conditioned or brainwashed to believe what they're doing is right, and that bloodlust that takes over them, that, you know, going a whole examination of war and psyche, I guess, but I feel for them. I feel sorry for them. And Israeli moms and dads who lose their kids, their heartbreak is as awful as the Palestinians' moms and dads who lose their kids. I mean, it's just that this political leadership we have, so willing to just waste, to destroy, to ruin people for their own purposes. You know, that's all there in everything we're saying. But at the same time, if you were to cut that out and just take an objective step back, which I think is what the folks who come on your program try and do, this is a bad move for the Americans. This is a bad move for the American empire. Like, I'm not proposing the American empire continue forever. I'm not opposed to its decline. I'm certainly not opposed to its disappearance. I think the world be a much better place as a multipolar world. But if we go out kicking and screaming and thrashing, if we try to maintain control by crushing and crumbling everything, but, you know, where is that going to lead to? What will come? You know, we've been lucky in the United States for our existence. You know, Abraham Lincoln talked about this, about how, you know, we're defended by these two oceans. You know, there's, you know, we've got, oh gosh, there's a great, now I'm trying to, I can't remember who it was who said it, but like, you know, we've got peaceful neighbors to the north and to the south, and to our east and west, we have fish. And if someone remembers whose quote that is, please put that in the chat. But anyway, yeah, I mean, in what we're wrecking, the good thing we have, what we could do as a nation otherwise. But aside from that aspirational perspective, just again, taking back this objective view as a foreign policy professional, as a former professional warrior, you know, as whatever we call ourselves, this is unwise. These are mistakes we are making. This is not a good move. If this is a chessboard, do not move your rook this way. You're going to put your queen in danger, kind of thing. You know, I mean, like, this is unwise. This is unsound. The idea that somehow we should be pursuing policies that further isolate us. Somehow we should be pursuing policies that continue the endless wars we've been in just in different manners and phases and different conditions. This is ludicrous. Why are we doing this? Why are we risking nuclear war in Eastern Europe for Ukraine? Where are the interests for the United States in maintaining Israel as a proxy, as an ally? Because the British did this in the 30s, because we inherited the British Empire, we now have to continue their interests? Does this make any sense to anyone? So I think that's the perspective a lot of us take. Or still, we have the heartbreak of watching what's happening in the world. We have the anger from seeing what our government has done. But then I think we also try and come to this with a degree of introspection and foresight of, okay, if you want to go along, I'll go along with your chessboard metaphor. That's a really stupid move you just made, you know. So I think that's how a lot of us view it. And I can't say enough. I'm grateful for the platform you provide, man. This is, you know, you're doing a tremendous service and it's our job, I think, to figure out how to get you out there to more people.
Thank you so much, Matt. Great pleasure, as always, to be with you.
Of course. Thank you, Nima.
See you soon, Matt.
You bet.